Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, and this is Insight is Capital. What does it take? What does it actually take to build wealth? Not manage it, not talk about it, but build it at the level of a career, a company, and a whole country. My guest today has done all three, from Bay Street's boardrooms and trading floors to backing some of Canada's most consequential fintech companies before anyone else saw it coming, to asking the hard questions about whether Canada is serious about competing on the world stage. Joe Canavan is here, principal at Canavan Capital. He's lived the full arc of Canadian finance, and he doesn't sugarcoat it.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Joe, welcome. It is terrific to have you on the show.
Thank you, Pierre. I couldn't be more excited.
I couldn't be more excited to have you. It's funny how, careers go full circle and then, you know, you come back into contact with people. And I feel that way about today's interview as well.
Well, because decades of intersection, right?
Absolutely. Again, welcome. It's terrific. Thank you so much for doing this and for joining me. Joe, I think there's a real, there's a lot to talk about today, but before we get into it, tell us about the arc of your career. Where did you begin? Although I think many people in the business who have been around know where you began, but where did that take you and how did that evolve into the mission you're on now?
I'll try and keep it briefer. But it all became very clear to me as a young person. I was given as much love and nurturing and support from my parents as they could give me. But as new Canadians and people with not a lot of money, I kind of grew up not really knowing what Bay Street was all about. And when I finished my business degree, I was determined to figure it out because I thought that was going to be a path to a better future for me, for ultimately what became my family. And then it became a mission for me, for the country. And when I looked around, I saw so many Canadians back in the 70s and 80s that, they were using Canada Savings Bonds. It was a big deal. If you remember,
yeah,
everybody
absolutely.
Was doing the Canada Savings Bond campaign every November and T-bills. Nobody was actually making money. Nobody was actually getting rich. Nobody was creating wealth. And so I became a retail advisor for 4 years. I loved it. It was awesome. But then one of my clients was a major insurance company. Asked me to write a thesis about private client. And basically the short version of the story was my thesis was, I think there's going to be way more money made in managed funds because there's way more Volvo station wagons in Canada than Ferraris, certainly back in 1989. And so that became my mission. I took a 20-year vision, a 10-year vision, 7, 5, and 3. And I basically said, we'll hit $100 billion and then we'll hit $1 trillion in managed funds. And at the time, mutual funds were $25 billion.
Yeah.
And so the short version of the story is I ended up at Fidelity when they basically fired 90% of their people. There were 4 people left and they had $60 million in assets. And we basically reconstructed what a much better offering could be for Fidelity, something that really spoke to their capabilities, where they were really powerful and strong, which was regional and global investing. And they didn't have any of that in their offering when they launched. So, we did that and it became a multi-billion dollar success story. And then I built another company called GT Global. And that was on the thesis that you could have global investment funds on themes. So global infrastructure investing, which is now all the rage.
Right.
Global technology, global telecom, global financial services. And so it was a whole part of the investment pyramid that didn't exist in Canada. And then, to really be different, because I needed to be different than our competitors, because our competitors were so good. And I just said, okay, we can't be like value funds and growth funds. What can we build? And we built something called a momentum fund back in that era. And it exploded on the upside. We were the fastest growing company to a billion, and we celebrated, and it was fantastic. And then I built one more company called Synergy Asset Management, and that was based on blending all those styles together.
Right.
Value with growth, with momentum and small cap, so you'd smooth out the volatility in investing. And my goal was very simple. How do we create wealth and prosperity for Canadian families? That was my mission then. It continues to be my mission now. I felt that if we could do those things, it would be a fulfilling life and create so much opportunity for Canadians. And 70% of marriages fail because of financial difficulty. So I actually felt it was going to be a really important mission for the country, because if you could keep the family unit together and give that capital back to those families, then they would invest more in their kids' sports, in education, in giving back to the community. You know, their church, their temple, whatever.
Yeah.
And it became a virtuous cycle. So that was kind of my thing. And then my last company got bought by CI Financial in a really well-negotiated deal. It was something I actually was excited to do, to turn around another company they were about to pay $1 billion for. So CI bought Synergy and Asante Wealth Management the same day. But, you know, Bill Holland, who was the CEO at the time, said, you know, this is a dog's breakfast, right? You're the seventh CEO in 5 years. It's going to be a nightmare for you. But we agreed that we could pull that off, and now it's hundreds of billions. So it was great. And then I retired for a bit, on purpose. We were going to do a couple of other deals, and I promised I would come back to CI if Bill got those deals done. But I was so blessed to have such a great family, and my three boys were all really good athletes. So I wanted to be there. And so I started to go to all their games, all their practices, help with some of the coaching. So it became one of those things where I was fulfilled. I was having a good time. And then along the way, people would call me for advice. And they're like, listen, you know, you've spent, you know, decades on Bay Street. I've got this idea. Can you take a look? And so, you know, one of them was Wealthsimple. Another one was Coho Financial. Another one was Layer 6. And it just kept compounding. Now Cap Intel, HomeWise. And so it became one of those things where I would vet these companies and, you know, I would take a look more closely. Now, because I wasn't going to be the CEO, I was going to be either an advisor to the founder or a board member. It still gave me lots of time. So one of my charity boards was struggling. And so the board said, would you just finish taking care of that other company, Asante? Do you think you can fix Children's Aid Foundation? So I stepped off the board there for 2 years to become the CEO, you know, fixed it, put in a new team, new branding, new messaging, put in a new CEO, and went back on the board and became chairman. And then I did the same thing at Next Canada. So, you know, I've been their first board member and been on the board for 10 years, and I was their fifth CEO in 4 years. So I said, you get 2 years, and then I'm going to put a new person in, and then I'm going to come back on the board. So generally, I think, Pierre, that's kind of what I like to do. So I like to help founders build. I want to give people who are great leaders, deep-rooted family values, high integrity, perseverance, like really driven people. Michael Katchen, who built Wealthsimple, is that person. Daniel Eberhardt, who's building Coho, is that person. James Rockwood, who's building Cap Intel. So it's always about those leadership skills. So I get to do my philanthropy, and I get to do the foundational stuff that matters to me, which is empowering and supporting those visionary leaders who are building a better Canada and a better world, quite frankly.
Joe, that is an amazing career story. Like, I can't help thinking, you're like, you know, I mean, I think you definitely had the great fortune, and you know, I benefited from it as well, of being in an industry that discovered, you know, mutual funds, managed fund products when Canada was deeply in need. You know, you mentioned the Canada Savings Bonds. I mean, as an advisor in those days, you know, that was everything. Like, somebody came in with Canada Savings Bonds and was like, okay, you got to convert these. You know, you're not making any money. You're just treading water here. Right. So that was number one. But I can't help feeling like you've been like this, the accidental capitalist, Like, you know, you're like Michael Corleone in Godfather 3. You know, just when I think I'm out, they drag me back in, right? and so it's not like, it sounds to me like you weren't actually out there, you know, deliberately chasing these opportunities. You know, like, no. Wealth Simple.
Oh my gosh.
Right?
You're coming to my door. They're like, hey, that guy over there, he's been around a long time. He's not working. Go talk to him. I honestly thought they were doing it because they're like, I can't help this person. Maybe he can. And I literally became the guy that people would call because, okay, I got to give them something. So I'm going to give them Canavan. And that's how a lot of these companies got to meet me. Like Coho, I remember Daniel was speaking at some conference in New York. He was flying through on a stopover back to go home in Vancouver. And somebody said, would you do me a favor? Would you meet with this? He's a brilliant young guy, single. He had raised by a single parent, his mother, you know, high integrity, high character, totally a Joe kind of guy. And so I said, listen, I'm happy to meet with him. I don't know how I can help him. And we met for coffee and I literally had 30 minutes to give this guy. And I kept pushing back my next meeting. I loved him so much. I thought he was such a driven, thoughtful, rich human being.
Yeah.
That I think my meeting ended up being 90 minutes and we were sharing more stories about values and books that we were reading and that sort of thing. But that led me to understand who he was, his character, and what he would become in building a challenger bank, which is what Coho is. And so, you know, it's one of those things, you're doing a favor, you're trying to be helpful. And I really wanted to say no to being another, I was on 9 boards at the time. So I really didn't have room. And I'd already put a bunch of capital aside and I wasn't really a trained VC. And, but I had to say yes. You just couldn't say yeah. No, this guy.
But you surfaced in that convoy, didn't you? So
yeah. And it became my life. You know, and I love it. That's how I ended up doing the Next Canada thing. I think I became their first board member. It was called Next 36 in 2010 when it launched, because I thought that was a path to a better Canada. In 2010, we didn't have an innovation and entrepreneurship ecosystem. And so I was their first board member. I think I was their first check. If not, I was their second. I loved the founders. The 4 founders were terrific. Reza Satchu, Ajay Agarwal, Tim Hodgson, and Claudia Hepburn. And then I became a mentor to one of the startups and so on. And I was on that board for 10 years until I became the CEO. But again, every year we were building 70 to 100. We were training, educating, supporting, structuring all these great startup ventures for Canada until we blew it up after a while. Not Next, but you know, the way we chased a lot of money out of the country, which has really hurt the ecosystem. I'd love to rebuild it. But that was a passion project for me because I thought if we're going to build a better Canada, if we're going to have an innovation and creation future, this is what has to happen. And I'm just writing a piece right now
called,
you know, The New Canadian Dream, or Rethinking the Canadian Dream, because it's dead. We killed it, unfortunately.
I love the nation building angle that you're on in terms of you know, reestablishing Canadian capital markets. I just recall, you know, we did this feature about, it's got to be at least 10 years ago. Where we, you know, every day we featured an invention that was a Canadian invention, like the charged couple device, for example, the radio phone, you know, all of these components that eventually became combined into what is today an iPhone or an Android phone, like the phones of today with, you know, it's got everything. It's got camera, it's got the screen, but all of those innovations were piecemeal invented by Canadian engineers.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look back on that and you think, what happened? Right. And I think the story is in a nutshell is that, you know, as Canadian investors, just, you know, at large, obviously I can't point to anything or anyone specific, but we took too long to react to the opportunity. And then inevitably what happens historically is that these incredible, these marvels, these technology marvels travel across the border, and someone on the other side of the border decides, wow, this is incredible. What happens so often is that American investors with deeper pockets find these opportunities and fund them.
But let me give Canada some props for a bit. And then I'm going to say truth. And then I'm going to say opportunity. Because in 2010, Next is born. In 2012-13, Creative Destruction Lab is born, you know, Ajay Agarwal. And then Velocity. And then all the incubators and accelerators coming out of the university system. We started to build an ecosystem. Now, arguably, we were on Fund 1, Fund 2, so we were new at it. We were maturing. We were growing. People were taking more risk. But at the time, capital gains tax was quite a bit lower, and the environment for taking risk was getting a little bit more robust. And because 80% of these companies fail, you really do need to pay for risk. I mean, if I have a chance of losing 80% of the time when I step up to bat, it's actually 90, but I'd say 80 to be conservative. You got to let me do it, and you got to not punish me with, you know, infrastructure and taxation and whatnot. So we started to build, we started to grow all the universities, and then we were commercializing some of the stuff coming out of the hospital system and out of the universities, and people were staying here now. The money was coming across the border from California, from Texas, from Florida, from New York.
Right.
And instead of, because I used to go down to the Valley all the time, they used to try and get the Canadian companies to go there. I'm giving you $5 million, $10 million. Dollars. We want you to move here. That's why there's 700,000 Canadians in that area in California. But what started to happen is they said, listen, you guys are actually figuring this out. And you're building the ecosystem. You've got great universities. You've got great engineering programs and science programs and physics programs and so on. So why don't we, especially with the weak Canadian dollar, why don't we let you stay in Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, Calgary, whatever, right. Halifax. And the real estate is less expensive. The labor is less expensive, and the ecosystem is for real now. And you're forming your own capital because you've got your own venture funds. Yeah, Andreessen, we're on fund 23. You're on fund 2. But, you know, that was kind of what they were saying. And they started to write articles about Canada as being Silicon North. So you're right. Like, holy smokes. Again, I felt like the luckiest guy on earth. Just like I was early in mutual funds, I wanted to be early in tech. It's why I focus so much on artificial intelligence. I try to take a 10-year view and then work back 7, 5, 3, 1. And so I was in this beautiful wave of momentum. And then unfortunately, the government of the time, I'm not naming names, and the finance minister blew it up. And you're just like, what? It's self-inflicted. We started to keep people here. Instead of losing 100,000 entrepreneurs a year, we were keeping them here. Companies were building here. They were choosing Canada. Americans and Europeans were choosing to come and build companies here. And now the wealth is leaving. The risk-taking is gone. Not totally gone, but it's essentially gone. The venture capitalists that were coming across the border went back to Asia, went back to Europe, and went back to the States. So we had the conditions for change and for growth and for opportunity, and then we took them away. And so that's really the problem that I see. I see it as a huge opportunity. You know, we got so caught up in all the woke stuff and whatever, you know, it was all the virtue signaling. I'm like, no. This is an economy that has an abundance of riches. We have rich geography. We have energy. We have mining. We have forestry. We have really smart people coming out of our university systems. We have innovation. We have entrepreneurs, people who are willing to take risks. And I kept saying when I came into the role as CEO of Next, I'm like, where is Canada's Google? Where is Canada's Apple? Where is Canada's whatever, you know, Microsoft? Because we could build those companies here. But essentially what happens time and time again is we build one and then that's it. And we have the tallest poppy syndrome. We need to get rid of that. We need to celebrate winners. We need to celebrate risk takers, Pierre. Like my son told me.
It's terrible policy making, right? I mean,
it's all policy. It's 100%
look at what's happening. Like, look at what's happening. It's happening in Canada, but look at what's happening in California.
Yep.
Californians are fleeing to Florida, right? Yep. They're going where they can be less, you know, less encumbered. And you know, that those encumbrances of bad policy making, that's really why so much capital and technology fled Canada.
Incentives drive outcomes. Very simple. Yep. Charlie Munger, one of the most successful investors of all time, one of the simplest minds, most powerful minds in investment history. You show me the incentive, I will show you the outcome. Full stop.
Yeah.
And we disincentivized risk-taking. We made it hard for companies to form. We made it harder for capital to form. And so it goes where the opportunities are. And so it left. And now I'm left here taking on these companies that are asking for lead orders and whatnot, which are giant checks. And I'm like, when I become the backstop for a lead order, you know Canada's not in great shape. Because I'm not a VC fund. I chose specifically not to be a fund because of all the other responsibilities that go with it. And that's the unfortunate part. And I've had people in my office this week who, one person who's building a brilliant company, a really talented young female CEO. And I said, tell me about your company. Tell me about the opportunity. Tell me where you raised your capital. Vinod Khosla, Khosla Ventures in California. Like, like $14 million. That's amazing. Who gave it to you? And I was hoping he was going to say somebody Canadian. It didn't happen to be. But anyhow.
You were, Joe, I interrupted you. You were going to say something about your son.
Oh, yeah. So my kids, all three of them are engineering students or grads. And, you know, they're
fantastic.
Entrepreneurial. And they're probably going to end up doing a business degree as well. We'll see. It's up to them. But, you know, my middle guy said, Dad, you know, I can do simple math, and I look at the math of living in Austin, Texas. I can do the math of living in Miami because a bunch of our friends, our network, have moved to California, Miami, sorry, Texas, Nashville. One friend just bought a house in Nashville, you know, because these are all, you know, right-to-work states and have a very competitive tax structure. Like, I was in Austin last week, and the place is booming. And it's full of young people. All that opportunity, they're basically coming together to embrace that opportunity. Incentives drive outcomes, right? So my son's like, well, Dad, what Canada really needs is 2, 3, 4 million more millionaires. And I said, geez, Hayden, why is that? He goes, if you can create the conditions for more millionaires, that means more companies get formed here. More innovation, more creation, more capital raising, more businesses launch and stay here. So if kid graduates from U of T, Waterloo, Queens, Western, they start that company here because the capital is here. They hire their people who graduated with them, or they hire other Canadians or new Canadians. So over a period of 10 years with a very clearly articulated vision, you would end up, if you had 3, 4, 5 million more millionaires, with millions more jobs, and all those employees would probably have access to stock options, or many of them. So you've got more opportunity, more growth, more potential for gain, a better life, a better country, more revenue for the government, more basically more productivity and more foreign investment. So it's a virtuous cycle where you say, this is who we want to become. You know, I wrote something 2 years ago called Innovation Nation 2034, because I was asked to give a speech and it was so negative that I felt so guilty that I went to the guy who asked me to be the keynote speaker. And I said, I'm so sorry. If I get up on stage and tell you and tell your 2000 guests what I really think is happening in this country right now, they were bringing in an increased capital gains tax, 66% inclusion rate, and other ridiculous policies. Anyway, doesn't matter. I just said, people are going to start crying in their seats, and it's going to be horrible. So I owe it to you. You were very thoughtful to invite me. I'm going to go back to my hotel room, and I'm going to rethink my entire speech. Instead of Canada is on a terrible path, it's here's what Canada could become with some very thoughtful strategy. Do own the podium for entrepreneurship, for risk takers, just like we did for the Olympics, just like we've done for basketball. You know, look at the top five draft picks last year were Canadian. Right? You look at tennis. We took a very concentrated approach to tennis in Tennis Canada. Some of my friends were on the board there. I thought, this is beautiful. This is visionary. And 10 years later, we're on the world stage. So why don't we do this for the most essential part of our economy, building companies? All this artificial intelligence can stay here. And it was originally meant to. All those great ideas coming out of our research hospitals, those can be commercialized here. But we've scared it away. We can bring it back. Intentionalize the message, intentionalize the strategy, and you will have, as I said, more jobs, more growth, more revenue, more capital investment, more productivity, and more self-esteem. The other thing people want is they want fulfillment. They want a feeling of self-esteem or confidence or independence. We have so many people in our economy that work for one level of government or another. I really don't know that that's the answer. Big government is not the answer. And I'm not being political at all here. I'm not right or left. I'm just saying people would prefer a role that gives them, it feeds their soul. And a job can feed your soul. I've been working in companies for years, and I built culture. I built opportunity. I gave everybody an opportunity to build success. And the one thing that unified us is we had a common goal, a common dream. That's all a business is. It's a group of people that come together that share a vision for what that company or what that opportunity can become in its simplest form. And that is what could power Canada, a virtuous cycle of growth and opportunity. And that should be the Canadian dream. And if we're going to invite new people, you know, new Canadians to come to Canada, well, let's not be reckless about immigration. Let's target people that we think are going to be value add to our economy. They're going to help our economy be better, be faster, be more creative. I love good immigration. I love smart immigration. But that really deserve to be here and want to be here and want to build a better life for them and their family as part of the Canadian fabric.
Yeah, I mean, when you stop and consider, you know, the closure, the, you know, near closure of the H-1B visa in the U.S., you know, we have an opportunity to capture that.
Yeah.
Right? I can't help thinking, like, you know, like one thing just to touch on something you said is the, you know, this idea of what Canada could be. Like, I think that is such a recurring theme. It's a recurring sentiment. I suspect greatly that last year and all the, you know, all the stress and chaos that occurred with, you know, the 51st state chatter and all of that really woke up a lot of us to this idea that, that no goddamn way that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Right. And then suddenly you realize, you know, here's what we have to lose. Right. And you don't want to do a speech about what we're going to lose. That was a great point you made. You know, you want to do something inspiring to wake, you know, like a wake up call. Here's what's possible. And I think that's a sentiment that's nationwide, like among a lot of business people, which is like, you know, this country is so amazing. We're capable of so much, and so much of it is being disincentivized.
So I believe you're absolutely right. The leader of the United States scared people so strongly that it became a rallying cry.
Yes.
And we said, we're going to bring all their smart people across the border. The problem is, we keep losing our people because, and again, I don't want it to be political, but when you charge people 54% tax at a low rate of 220, I mean, if any of my kids move to Austin or Miami, wherever they're going, It's 33%. So it's simple math. And it's at a much higher breakpoint, right? I mean, I would extend that curve. It's hard to live in a major city in Canada right now as a single income parent. Like if we want family values and the commitment to family and maybe going back to the old school where one spouse stays home, you can't do it at that level of taxation, right? So, you know, I worry that unless you're not attracting people north of the border, in constricting, confining tax infrastructure. So we need to rethink tax policy.
100%.
If we got the 54 down to 45 or 48 or whatever it was 10 years ago, it doesn't have to go to zero. I'm not saying that. You'll find that there's a lot more revenue generated for the government. And you'll find that the capital gains tax, as an inclusion rate goes down, there'll be more risk on. So it'll be one of those things where all those things connect and you start to see the engine start to feel the grease, the oil. And over a period of time, it starts to grow again. And then you will have those people come across the border. But right now, it's too constricting. And it's too hard to live with the cost of living in Canada with a tax regime that is so tight where, you know, we keep hiring more people and we keep doing all these things and we keep spending. And we keep taxing. That's not a recipe for growth.
It's exhausting.
Or stagnation.
It's exhausting.
It is.
It is exhausting.
And that's the unfortunate truth is.
We need that flywheel.
A lot of those big capitalist people that took all the risk in the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years have been questioning whether or not they have a future here. And, you know, I was with somebody last week who he just sold his house. He's on his way out.
Yeah.
And it wasn't one conversation. You know, it's happening all the time. It's happening for the young people that are graduating because the conditions for opportunity and for growth aren't there for the 20 and 30 somethings, especially if they're capped.
Yeah.
And it's not there for the 40, 50, 60, 70 somethings that want to invest back into Canada. So how do we rethink that? If we want to be Innovation Nation, we need tax policy that supports that. If we want the new Canadian dream, we need the policy underpinning that supports that. We'll build a better, happier, more fulfilled Canada with a few thoughtful tweaks or changes. And I think our prime minister could be a legacy prime minister beyond just, you know, now finally meeting our obligations on defense or now spending some money on infrastructure. Those are government programs. That's not empowerment. That's not fulfillment. Nothing against him, but this is his opportunity to be a legacy prime minister.
Amazing. I wholeheartedly agree. Joe, you've been in and around the financial industry for long enough to watch the whole movie a few times, you know, rate cycles, bubbles, recoveries. We talked about the policymaking cycle, you know, which has gone from progressive to regressive. And now, you know, I can't tell you how much I appreciate, you know, your effort to reverse that regressive cycle. You've been through tech booms. We're still in one right now. What's the one thing about capital and human behavior that never actually changes, no matter how different the era looks on the surface?
Capital always finds opportunity. It finds the future. It's like, you know, a babbling brook. You've got rocks and all kinds of impediments that show up time and time again. And, you know, through my career, we had, you know, the crash of 87. We had the Latin American debt crisis. We had the Russian ruble crisis. We had the tech wreck. We had all these things that happened, but capital finds a way because innovation finds a way because creativity finds a way and people want to hope for a better tomorrow and people. The Jeff Bezoses of the world and the Bill Gates of the world and, you know, other great leaders, they find the idea in their head. And then they say, you know, sure, I could go and take a job at Bank America, but if I were to do this, I might create a better tomorrow for my country, my family, my whatever. And they're incentivized to do it. I think that's what we're really thinking about here is, you know, how are we creating that? I look at Canada and I look at the United States. There's going to be $3 to $5 trillion invested in the next 5 years in artificial intelligence. I was in San Francisco meeting with a bunch of the AI companies 4 weeks ago. Maybe 6 weeks ago. Anyways, everywhere I went, these folks are working. They called it 9x9x6. They're working every day, 12 to 9 is an yeah. understatement, 9 to 9. I had dinner with one guy. We had this fabulous, you know, Michelin star dinner. And I said, so you're going to go for a nightcap? You're going to go see your girlfriend? And he goes, no. I'm hosting my team for a dinner at 10:30 tonight.
Oh, wow.
He goes, no. I'm going to be there at least till midnight.
Yeah.
And then I'll go home, you know, shower, have a good sleep, and then I'll be back in the office around 7:30. So that's what's happening. That's what's happening when you give people that opportunity. They see that they are on the cusp, on the leading edge, and they see that there's a giant race in technology. I hope this is answering your question. Because in the last 5 to 10 years, China has seen whoever wins the AI race rules the world. So they were spending $500 million. Now it's up to $1 trillion. Saudi Arabia, similarly, $500 million. America, because it's not government funded as much as it's really private capital, it's whatever it takes. The capital forms, it comes into those opportunities, it flows to these businesses. And I saw deals done while I was sitting in a boardroom down there with numbers that I had never seen in my life. And they were confirmed that night. And I'm just like, wow.
Yeah, this astonishing.
This is opportunity. This is creation. This is innovation in action. We'll call it capitalism in action. $100 billion deal while this person was sitting with us. I was so impressed. Like the Americans really, you know, they've got lots of things that people are, you know, angry at them right now in terms of geopolitics. But I mean, as a people, these guys are scrappy. They want to build cool things. They want to do great and wonderful things. They want to be the leader of the free world. And they're showing it when you look at, you know, Anthropic and OpenAI and Grok and SpaceX. And it's all happening. It should be happening here as well. But it's there.
It's amazing. You know, when you like, you know, we're not here obviously to slag the US in any way. Like to your point, I think one thing I love about traveling to the States is that, you know, especially, you know, the big cities, Boston, New York, LA, you get, you know, they're exciting cities. There's so much going on. They're vibrant. There's nightlife. People are out, you know, because, and they're out at night because they, you know, maybe they worked hard. Maybe they had a long day and they want to go and unwind and socialize, be with their friends. But there's also this edge, right? There's also this edge in the US, which is a little bit of danger, a little bit of risk, a little bit of, you know, like that something you could turn the next corner and something either exciting or dangerous could happen. Like, you know, like I think that's one of the things that's so universally attractive about America is that it's got, you know, all of it all the time, all wrapped up in this one package. Just to sum up kind of what you were just saying, which is that, you know, these guys who work in the AI space are working, you know, 18 hours a day. Whether it's, you know, the actual work or managing, taking their people out and then go home and sleep for 6 hours and back in the office again first thing, because they're excited. They've got a fever. Like there's a feverish dream because, and going back to your point about Charlie Munger's quote, which is about, you know, show me the incentives, they have the incentive. So you know,
it's all there, Pierre. And it comes back to something you said at the very beginning. What drives us? It's about leadership.
Yeah.
And that has been lacking in our country. I think we're getting back to it. I'm hoping and praying we're getting back to it. I'm helping organizations behind the scenes politically to get back to visionary, strategic, thoughtful leadership. And how do we empower our people? How do we enrich our country? How do we support people in becoming creative and achieving their dreams? And, you know, my wife is on a number of arts boards. I think we have an opportunity to excel in the arts in terms of medical and biotechnology. I'm involved in investments in biotech and some of the, you know, hospital boards here. Like, there's so much that we can be doing better with thoughtful leadership. And we need thoughtful leadership, strategic leadership, visionary leadership, you know, federally, provincially, and municipally. And we're starting to get there, but we, you know, we lost our way for a while. And I'm hoping we're back. I think there's some more changes that I don't want to bring up here, but I'm crossing my fingers we have some more changes locally, because, you know, in Toronto, we're beset with 17 break-ins a day. I mean, honestly, congestion that I've never seen before, which it's not strategic, it's not thoughtful, you know, in a city that has grown from 2 million to 4 million to 6 million, going to grow to 10. You know, we can't have the congestion and the crime and the cost of living that we have. We need good leadership. And, you know, it's making it so difficult for people to get into their office. It's making it so difficult for families to go out for dinner, to go to a park that there aren't commitments, to go to a Blue Jays game. It's just so difficult to get around. And so there's, again, we can get there. It's all about leadership. It's about people that really deserve and altruistically want Canada, want Ontario, want Toronto or any other major city to be better than it was before they got there. And that was always my goal as a CEO or as a leader of anything. Is this organization better than when and how I found it? And that's what leadership is. You're bringing people together to achieve greatness or achieve a goal.
Joe, everyone, like, coming back to, you know, some of your ventures, everyone talks about the apps, the brands, the unicorns. You know, that's the exciting stuff, the things that actually come to market and make it and succeed. But you've been far more focused on the plumbing underneath. Why does financial infrastructure matter more than most people realize? Like, it's not enough to just have great ideas.
Pierre, I think the answer is the plumbing and all of the foundational infrastructure becomes so important and are going to become more important as we go from AI to artificial general intelligence, which I think is coming based on my meetings, based on what I'm hearing, based on what I'm reading in the next 2 years, 3 years, mm-hmm. You know, others are saying 5 to 10. It feels like it's coming at an accelerating pace. So if I, as a Canadian or as a consumer, want access to my healthcare, my finances, my retail, you know, when I'm buying things online, I need to know that I'm secure, that my information is confidential, that I have ease of access 24/7, and that I have a very, very low probability because of encryption and other technologies that I'm not going to be hacked or damaged in any way. And so that infrastructure, that plumbing is there to ensure from start to finish that I feel confident, I feel secure in whatever that transaction might be. And if we lose that, then we lose the trust in the system. And so, you know, one of the things that I think is really happening with financial institutions around the world is they're spending and focusing disproportionately on this because that's their reason for being. That's their lifeblood. And so it's absolutely imperative that they keep the security of their clients and that information safe.
It's a great, I mean, it's a really important investment theme. First of all, cybersecurity, And I agree with you that artificial general intelligence is coming sooner. I think the part that's underestimated by, you know, observers is that artificial intelligence is educating itself.
It is recursive learning. It learns 24/7 across a network. You're 100% right here. 100%. The thing that I think that if I had one huge fear but opportunity is not just AGI, is I met recently with a bunch of CEOs and the CEO of Xanadu, Christian Weedbrook, and he's building a quantum computing company. And that'll take AI together with quantum to a whole other level of exponential growth that I can't calculate. I don't have the brain power for it. I actually don't know many people that do. But I keep asking because I see it coming. And I met with him. I met with his team. I looked at the infrastructure. I looked at all the wiring. I looked at all the things that they're building. I looked at their vision for the future. And I'm just like, Christian, this is magnificent. And he's staying in Canada. You know, I'm really, really excited that here's a guy who could live anywhere because he's Australian. And yet he's here. So, he's got a big brain. He's got an incredible team. But that technology, together with artificial intelligence, it's going to be game changing. And the other thing that I look at is robotics. I just think that you're going to see more and more and more. And this is where, you know, love him or hate him, Elon Musk is a visionary for a reason. He saw electric vehicles long before. He saw reusable rockets long before. Well, you know what? He's building Optimus robots long before anybody knows that we're going to be using them and they're going to be ubiquitous. So I look at quantum, look at AGI, and then I add a layer of robotics on top of that. This is where I spend all my time researching and learning and talking and trying to understand, because I need to predict where the future is going to be in 20 years and then in 10 years, 7, 5, and 3 to be able to embrace the right investment thesis and position my life and position my family, if you will, for where the future's going. And, you know, it takes me back to the Wayne Gretzky quote, you know, go where the puck is going, you know, where the puck is going to be. You know, that's how he became so exceptional. He could see things that nobody else could see, and he would make himself available, and he could see that, you know, Mark Messier would be passing the puck to a place that nobody's there, but Gretz knew it was coming, and so he would skate there. And as a former hockey player, I marveled at the things that he could see with his peripheral vision, even more by Connor's peripheral vision. I see what Connor did in Canada, and I'm just like, wow. But that's it. I learned that early from a hockey metaphor. And, you know, I've always, like, as I was with mutual funds, as I am with technology, as I am with startups in AI and robotics, where's the world in 2036? And then I work back from there.
Powerful. And the timelines are compressing, right? Yeah. I mean, you spoke about quantum.
I actually go away every 2 years for a one-on-one, just with myself on a retreat. And I do a whole bunch of vision board work on which industries are going to be the industry of the future. I try to condense it down to 5 inside of that industry, one of the most compelling verticals. And then I come to an investment thesis. And listen, investing isn't hard. It just takes time. It takes work. It takes reading. It takes conversation. And so I'm constantly trying to figure those things out. I'm an investor in Radical AI. Jordan Jacobs has built one of the most important, powerful artificial intelligence venture capital funds here in Toronto. And the reason I'm an investor in that is not only does he have Fei-Fei Lai and Jeffrey on his board, he's got Tomi Putanen, who's one of the biggest brains in artificial intelligence. And this is Canadian. Well, it's global money, but it's primarily Canadian money investing in artificial intelligence. So when I talk to Jordan or when I read their research, I know it's bleeding edge research. So I'm getting information that's available as an investor the moment it's happening. And I have a whole bunch of periodicals that I read that do the same thing, so that I can be informed, so that I can help predict that 10-year future.
You mentioned quantum computing. It's mind-blowing what they're doing with you know, the development of these computers and the way the machines actually look. And but if you again, if you stop and think about it for a moment, now you're not solely reliant on human brain power to get you to the developments faster. So you can see where, you know, if you want to talk about a singularity, there's a lot of convergence happening where one technology combined with, you know, several others is actually converging into this singularity of, you know, all technologies coming to fruition sooner. Because we have this added brain power. But it's such an incredible thing to contemplate.
That is exactly everything that I have learned. That is where we're coming to. And I don't know how else to say it. It's going to happen because the creation has begun and it can't be stopped. And it's happening on multiple continents, some in alignment, some at cross purposes, forcing people to, you know, pick their game up and really compete to be number one. Like, and that's what forces people to really bring their A game all the time, is the fact that they know if they don't do their very best, if they don't compete at the highest level, they're not going to win. And this is a game. And it is humanity and it is creation, but it's also about winning. Because if you lose, unfortunately, you lose the opportunity, you lose the right. And so I think America's on a path right now. Quite frankly, China's probably, based on everything I see and read, is probably 6 to 9 to 12 months behind. I see it as, I'm giving Saudi props too, you know, based on what I'm hearing and what they're doing and how they're employing artificial intelligence over the next 1 to 2 years in the administration walls of government. I mean, they're doing so many things well. You know, they have zero cost of healthcare, zero cost of education, but their education system is much stronger than others, and zero tax. Right. They're taking the bounty that God gave them in energy. And they're saying, how do we build a great opportunity for our people? But we know that it's a finite resource and we're trying to be, you know, right minded about how we impact the world. So how do we build a better future? And I think that's why they've been betting so heavily on artificial intelligence and energy, other forms of energy, which they have been. And it really is. Again, it's very enlightened leadership, and I'm really impressed.
Well, speaking of leadership, you were an early backer of Wealthsimple, which is a story that I think, you know, people have come to know rather well. But before the revenue, before the proof, is when you got involved.
Yeah.
What are you really betting on when you write that first check, and has your answer changed or shifted at all after watching founders either succeed or fail up close?
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say I got lucky. I found one of the greatest entrepreneurs early. You know, here's a young man who said he was going to disrupt everything that I built in my entire career. And I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And I loved his values. I met his parents, which I don't always do, but I really thought they were special. I met his leadership team, A's Hire A's. They were superstars. He had all the tools, and he'd been around startups for a little while, and he was well-educated. And I looked at the cap table and I looked at the other folks who were going to invest in the early round alongside him and then ultimately me. And it was people like Daniel DeBow, who's done, you know, he's done Helpful and Shopify, and John Kelleher, who, you know, was, you know, Harvard, and then he was the chairman of Next and then McKinsey, and now he's the chief operating officer of CBC, Brent Belzberg from TorQuest, Sam Saif from Purpose. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, look at this stellar cast of investors. So I'm like, you know what? I know all these guys, and I think they're some of the smartest people in the country. So why don't I just put my money alongside them, believe in Michael, believe in the vision for Wealthsimple. He at the time said he had a vision for $1 trillion, which I thought was a little outlandish, seeing as he was at, you know, zero. But he's on his way. And it's the same. You know, when I think about James Rockwood at Cap Intel, when I think about, you know, the folks that I talked about at Layer 6, I mean, they ended up selling to TD for $100 million. You know, I selfishly thought they should have held on for twice that, because I thought they were too humble. I thought they were worth more. But, you know, founders have to do what founders want to do. And but did I invest in Jordan's next company? Yes. Mm-hmm. Did I invest in Tomi's next company, the co-founder? Yes. Michael Katchen phoned me. He said, Rachel Zimmer and I are going to build something called Simple Ventures. We're going to build 10 new companies to really build strong businesses for Canada, blah, blah, blah. 4 minutes. I said, how much do you need and when do you need it? He goes, that's it. I said, Michael, it's you. And Rachel is a superstar. She worked with another friend of mine years ago, and he couldn't stop raving about her. So again, it's always about the people.
Absolutely.
Once you build trust with me, it's so much easier to get money out of me. And so, yeah, I gave money to Jordan. Yeah, I gave money to Michael, because I believe that these are winners. These are people who are going to build something special. And again, it's altruistic. This is the thing. I was giving a speech last year, and people were kind of going, what's he talk altruism? I said, when you have an 80% chance of failure, every time you invest $100,000 or $1 million, you can lose 80% of it. Mm-hmm. This is altruism. This is a form of charity. Sure, it's capitalism when it works, but the 8 times out of 10 that it doesn't work, it's kind of hard. It's painful. So it's altruism meets capitalism. And to come full circle, that's what I'm talking about when I talk about capital gains taxes and whatnot.
Yeah.
People are willing to invest in beings, Canadians. When they're willing to invest in Canadian companies, startups that are trying to change our world, change our country, make it easy, reduce the capital burden, the tax burden on these folks. And give them an incentive. Like if I have one winner or two winners out of 10, and then I take all of that money and put it into the next Canadian startup and the next Canadian startup, again, with an 80% chance of failure. If I'm dumb enough to do that, Pierre, let me do it. Don't ask me at the highest marginal rate, blah, blah, blah. Let it be.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, incentives drive outcomes. There are more angels that will come to the table. There are more venture funds that will get formed in Canada. That money from the US and Asia and Europe will come back across our borders. I'm guaranteed. I'm not only suggesting it, I guarantee it. Because just like that babbling brook, money finds opportunity. And this is where the opportunity would be and could be. And all those bright people that we keep graduating out of our university and college systems would say, wow, the conditions for growth are here. Maybe I don't need to go. Maybe I can build here. Maybe, maybe, maybe. And that's what we're really looking for, is be the land of hope and opportunity. And people will stay. Give them the opportunity to say yes. And you'll probably attract a whole bunch back home.
Yeah. And maybe we'll get out of that cyclicality of you know, policymaking.
And all those researchers and all the things that, you know, the ministers keep talking about that would come back or would come into Canada from foreign countries. Yeah. If you incentivize it, it'll make it a lot easier to move to a city like a Toronto that's so expensive. I mean, you gotta make it easy for them to live here.
So, Joe, last question.
Yeah.
I hope we're okay. Are we okay for time?
You know what? Yeah. I'm having so much fun. I don't even know what time it is. So,
okay, great, great.
Let's go.
So, last question, and be as specific as you can be. If you were handed the mandate to make Canada dramatically wealthier over the next decade, and you had to start on Monday morning, where would you begin?
Own the podium for startups. You know, it's what we've been talking about this whole time. Yep. If you want to create a nation of wealth and prosperity, you need to create the foundational infrastructure for that opportunity. If you want a country, a new Canadian dream built on fulfillment, self-esteem, happiness, productivity, capital growth, creativity, all of those things, that has to start with a crystal clear long-term vision. It can't be a 1 year, 3 year, minimum 10 years. And you have to guarantee it. I remember I had this conversation with one of our finance ministers a few years ago and basically said, never going to happen. And I'm like, what do you mean never going to happen? I thought you wanted to leave a legacy. I thought you wanted to build a great Canada. Yeah, that's not who we are. And I'm like, okay, so if it was me, that's what I would do. I would do my Innovation Nation and change the title to Innovation Nation 2037, you know, so we have a longer runway, or 2047, even better. And then say, okay, here's what Canada could become. Here's how powerful, here's how special, here's how spectacular we could be. We could, as my son said, have millions more millionaires, because the more millionaires, the more wealth for everyone, the more opportunity for everyone, the more jobs for everyone. This would be a bountiful country and an economy, not just government spending, private spending, capital formation at the individual, at the fund level. Like, that's what people want. And I think that, you know, and again, with such an important neighbor right across the border, and we're making all kinds of new friends and rekindling our powerful relationships in the UK and continental Europe and around the world. I mean, we really could be that engine for growth for the world. And it doesn't all have to come from the government balance sheet. Give it back to the people to some degree. Let those folks do it. And then the answer to where's our Google, where's our Apple, where's our Microsoft? It'll be here.
Yeah.
Instead of one Nortel, one RIM BlackBerry, one Shopify, we'll have 101. It will be so robust. There'll be so much growth. We will be at almost like 0% unemployment. So I think the opportunity is here. It's just a state of mind. It's a strategic vision that has to happen. For that Canadian dream to become manifest, we need to believe in it, we need to visualize it, and then we need to put all the tools in place to empower that capital to form and those companies to succeed.
Joe, that is wonderful, and I hope, you know, I hope people find it inspiring, because I think, you know, it's very easy to get caught up in what's wrong rather than what could be right or how it could be right. I've really enjoyed this conversation, Joe. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight. It's been terrific catching up with you.
Thank you, Pierre. I gotta be honest, this has been fun. I'm honored to be invited on as your guest. And I really hope that there's a nugget in here somewhere that people take away and it helps them, you know, fulfill their dreams.
I think there was many, many nuggets. I suspect that you know that.
I hope.
I love your humility.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.